sussed out by a sound expert if I ever needed it. I sent the video to Cisco and Jennifer so they would have copies. I also wrote a short note to accompany the file transfer. Looks like we touched a nerve. I returned to my spot on the couch next to Kendall, but found it hard to get back into the grind of going through the case files. "What exactly did they want?" Kendall asked. "I rattled their cage today," I said. "They wanted to rattle mine."
"Did they?"
"Nope."
"Good. You want to keep working?"
"Nah, I think I'm done for the night."
"Then let's go to bed."
"Good idea." But the move to the bedroom was interrupted by Cisco, who called after viewing the video I had sent. I told Kendall I'd be in a few minutes.
"That looked a little testy," Cisco said.
"They definitely aren't happy with the subpoena we dropped on them," I said. "Whatever they've got going at Biograin, they don't want us in the picture."
"But we stay with it, right?"
"Right. You hear anything from the Indians after this morning?"
"I got a report on the side piece. Still no sign of Aparicio."
"We have to find him. What about that other thing you were doing?"
"Yeah, I was going to fill you in tomorrow. There was nothing there tonight. No flags. After he left you at the house, he walked down the hill to Sunset, ordered food right there at Zanku Chicken, and waited for a ride. Then I see a car pull up, and it's his girlfriend."
"How'd you know it was his girlfriend?"
"Because I've been dropping off cash to her every week since you got popped."
"Right, forgot.
She had the kid in the car, too. They picked him up with dinner and went home to Inglewood, and that was it."
"He didn't make any calls?"
"A couple, but I had eyes on him. They were social calls. He was smiling, animated, not like he was reporting in as a CI.
Still, if we get the chance, we should check the phone. Get the call log. I want to be sure." I realized that my tone indicated that I was disappointed Bambajan Bishop didn't appear to be snitching for the prosecution or the police. And I guess I was. If he was snitching, I could use that to my advantage. Plus, get the ultimate payoff when it came time to expose the wrongdoing in court.
"I think after the jail surveillance thing, and now the missing wallet, they'd be crazy to try to submarine us," Cisco said.
"You're probably right," I acknowledged. "But stay on him one more night. You never know."
"Done."
"Okay, Cisco, thanks. We'll talk tomorrow." As soon as I disconnected, I thought about Bosch. I had not sent him the video of the confrontation with the two FBI agents. I called him directly, and he picked up after two rings.
"Hold on," he said. "Let me get clear."
I heard the distinctive sounds of a casino in the background, slot machine bells, people shouting. Then it got quiet, and Bosch said hello.
"It's Mick. Where the hell are you?"
"Vegas. You couldn't tell? I just checked in at the Mandalay."
"What are you doing there? I thought you were working for me."
I immediately regretted my choice of words. "With me, I mean."
"I am. That's why I'm here. Following something."
"Well, we struck a big nerve today with the Bureau. Two agents just showed up here to tell me we're barking up the wrong tree with Biograin, while confirming that we're barking up the right tree."
"They like to do that."
"Well, I don't know what you've got there, but I want to put everything we have into finding out about how Sam was mixed up with Aparicio and Biograin. I still think it's the magic bullet. It'll win the case."
"Got it. I should be back by tomorrow night."
"Are you going to tell me what you're doing?"
"Tracking Sam's scales. The last time he got caught was for a phony online fundraiser for the victims of the music festival shooting out here. Remember that? The shooter was actually here at the Mandalay."
"Of course. Another senseless act of hyper-violence, perpetuated by the easy access to high-powered weapons."
"You're not an NRA guy, are you?"
"No, I'm not."
"Anyway, the state of Nevada was all over these scams related to the shooting and grabbed scales in L.A. They extradited him back here for trial, and he cut a deal and did 15 months for fraud up at High Desert. I remember he called me from the can out there, wanted me to rep him, but I said no. But couldn't you have gotten all this by phone? I need you back here. Not what I'm doing tomorrow. High Desert State Prison is about an hour from here. Scales' cellmate is still there, and I'm going to go up and talk to him. Got it set up for 8 a.m. I'll head back to L.A. after that. You think he has something? He's serving a 5-year sentence for major fraud. He was selling phony casino chips, took in a couple million before they caught him. Anyway, these two spent 15 months together in a cell. I'm thinking they may have traded a few stories about things they did and were planning to do. Perfect. They put a fraud and a con artist together in the same cell. That's some match, I said. They usually try to keep white-collar guys together so they don't get picked off by the heavies. Thanks for schooling me. Sorry. I guess you know more about jails than I do, Barsh said. I don't know if that's a dig or a compliment. You fly over there or drive? Drove. Okay, call me when you're heading back. And then I want to get everybody together Wednesday after court to figure out the next steps. I'll be there. After disconnecting the call, I thought about things for a few minutes. I felt that the team was getting close to the big secrets of the case. We had a momentum that could lead us to truth and triumph. It was just a question of whether we would get there in time. Kendall called down the hall from the bedroom. Are you coming to bed or not? I stacked all the files I had spread around and got up from the couch. I dumped the files into my briefcase and clicked it closed. Coming. I headed into the hallway, and she was standing there in her bathrobe. I stopped short. Scared me, I said. You know, this has happened before, she said. What did? You know, you let your work take over your life, our lives, night and day. And then what we had disappeared. And here we are, back together, and already you're doing it again. I reached out and gently grabbed the robe's terry cloth belt, which she had loosely cinched around her waist. I tugged it playfully. Come here. This isn't the same thing, babe. This is me. My case. I have to put everything into it, or there might not be any future for us. We've got a month until trial. I just need you to put up with this for a month, okay? Can you give me that? I moved my hands up her arms to her shoulders and waited. She said nothing. She just looked down at the floor between us. You can't give me the month? I asked. She shook her head. It's not that, she said. I can give you the month, but sometimes it's like you're talking to me like a juror, like you're trying to convince me you're not guilty. I let go of her shoulders. And what, you think I am? No, I'm talking about the way you talk to me. I don't know what you mean, I said. But if you think I'm trying to play you, then maybe you should go to bed and I should go back to work. I have to figure out how to convince a real jury I'm not a killer. I left her there in the hallway. Chapter 22. Tuesday, January 14th. I worked late and fell asleep on the couch. I had forgotten to attach the charger to my ankle monitor, and it woke me at 8:15 a.m. with a sharp intermittent beeping that told me the device's battery would be dead in an hour, and I would be in violation of the terms of my bail. I timed the beeps. At the moment, the alarm was on a 5-second interval, but I knew that would get shorter and the device would get ear-piercingly louder as the hour counted down. I couldn't casually go into the bedroom to get the charger without the alarm waking Kendall, who liked to sleep in most mornings. But with no choice in the matter, I timed my move, went swiftly into the room, and managed to plug the charging cord into the ankle device before the next beep.
It appeared that Kendall had slept through. She was on her side, turned away from me, and I could see her arm moving with each rhythmic breath of sleep. I now had an hour to pass while the device charged, but I had left my phone, laptop, and briefcase in the living room. I could unplug the charger and race with it out of the room, but I felt I was pressing my luck already. And if the alarm sounded again, it would definitely wake up Kendall. The bedroom TV remote was on the bed within reach, having been left there by Kendall the night before. I turned on the flat screen and immediately muted the sound. I switched on the closed captions and started reading the news. The House was planning to send articles of impeachment to the Senate for what everybody in the country knew was a non-starter, but it was monopolizing the news feed. I watched and read captions for 20 minutes before another story broke in for a few seconds of airtime. It was a report on rising concerns in Asia after the mystery virus originating in Wuhan, China, was confirmed as having jumped borders to other countries. I heard my phone ringing out in the living room. I checked my watch. It was now 8:45, and I believed the ankle monitor had sufficiently charged to the point where there would be no alarm beep if I disconnected it. I quickly yanked out the charging line and moved quickly to get the phone. I missed the call, but saw it had come from Bosch. I called him right back. "Mick, there's an issue with the cellmate," he said. "You're at the prison?" I asked. "I'm here, and I saw the guy. His name is Austin Niederland, but he won't talk to me. Says he's got a name that will tell us all we need to know about what Sam Scales was into, but he wouldn't give me the name. What's he want? He's got to be through his appeals by now." "He wants you, Mick." "What's that mean?" "He said he would give only you the name he knows about you. Scales must have told him you were a good lawyer. Niederland says he'll give you the name if you just come up, sign in as his lawyer, and talk to him. See if there's anything to be done on his case, I guess. He's still got 2 years on his sentence. That means he still has to do 18 months.
"You mean today? Come there today?"
"Can you? I'll set it up and wait here for you."
"Harry, I can't. I've got an ankle monitor and bail restrictions. I can't leave the county."
"Shit, I forgot.
What about a video connection? Can we set up something like that?"
"I checked, and the prison only does it for court hearings. No teleconferencing, interviews, or attorney-client meetings." There was silence on the phone while I thought about this.
"So, what else did he say about this name?" I finally asked.
"I mean, what if we jump through all these hoops and he says, yeah, it's Louis Aparicio? Then we're nowhere. We already have that name."
"It's not Aparicio," Bosch said. "I tried that name on him and got a read. He didn't know it."
"Okay, so can this even be done today? I have court tomorrow. Even if I can convince the judge to let me go up there, I have to be back tonight, tomorrow morning at the latest. You think I can get in and out? It's a prison. They don't like cooperating with defense lawyers."
"Your call, Mick. But if you have to talk to the judge to get permission, maybe she can write you an order that gets you in."
"Different states, Harry. She doesn't have jurisdiction."
"Well, what do you want to do?"
"Okay, hold tight. I'll see what I can do. I'll call you back as soon as I know something." I disconnected and thought about the best way to approach this. Then I called Lorna and asked if there was anything on my schedule.
"Your first witness list is due today," she said, "but that's it. And then you have the continuation of yesterday's hearing tomorrow at 1.
"Okay, I already have a wit list ready," I said. "I'll send it in. I might be going to Las Vegas if the judge lets me."
"What's in Vegas?"
"A prison where Sam Scales last served time. I want to talk to the guy he shared a cell with."
"Good luck with that. Let me know."
I next called Judge Warfield's courtroom and got her clerk, Andrew. I said I wanted to set up a teleconference with the judge, requesting that I be allowed to leave the county for the day to pursue a witness.
The clerk said he would check with the judge and call me back. I reminded him that Dana Berg would need to be alerted. While I waited, I decided to act as if I would gain the judge's permission, and I booked flights on Jet Suite out of Burbank to Las Vegas. The outbound left in 2 hours. 30 minutes went by with no return call from the judge or her clerk. I called the courtroom back and pushed for an answer. Andrew said the judge was okay with a teleconference, but Dana Berg had not responded to a message left for her. "Can the judge just talk to me then?" I asked. "This is time-sensitive. I can see this potential witness today only and need to know whether I can go. If you leave a message for Berg saying when the conference is taking place, my guess is she'll respond and be on the call. If you just wait for her to call back, we're going to be waiting all day." The clerk took what I said under advisement and said he would get back to me. Another 20 minutes went by, and Andrew called, saying he was connecting me to a conference call with the judge and Deputy DA Dana Berg. My plane was leaving in 70 minutes. Soon, I heard the judge's voice on the phone.
"I think we have everybody here," she said. "Mr. Haller, you are asking for a deviation in bail restrictions?"
"Yes, Your Honor, just for one day," I said. "I need to go to Las Vegas to see a witness."
"Las Vegas, really, Mr. Haller?"
"It's not what you think, Judge. I won't be anywhere near the Strip. Sam Scales was last incarcerated at High Desert State Prison, about an hour north of Las Vegas. His cellmate is still there, and I want to talk to him. The prosecution has given us nothing through discovery regarding Scales' activities leading up to the murder. The cellmate could be an important witness for the defense. One of my investigators is at the prison as we speak. He said the inmate will only talk to me. I've booked an 11:40 flight to Vegas and a 7 o'clock flight back."
"That was a bit presumptuous, was it not, Mr. Haller?"
"No, Your Honor. I did not anticipate how the court would rule. I just wanted to make sure I could get there should the court allow it."
"Ms. Berg, are you still with us? Does the prosecution object to the defense request?"
"Here, Your Honor," Berg said. "I would first like to ask the name of the inmate he's going to see."
"Austin Niederland," I said. "He's at High Desert State Prison."
"Your Honor," Berg said, "the state objects to this travel outside of bail restrictions and maintains its original argument from the bail hearing. We believe Mr. Haller is a flight risk. More now than before, because the closer we get to trial, the clearer it becomes to Mr. Haller that his conviction and permanent incarceration are certain."
"Judge, the prosecution statement is ridiculous," I said quickly. "I've now been out of custody for 5 weeks, and I've done nothing but prepare for my defense, even with the handicap of being pitted against a prosecution that does not like to play by the rules."
"Your Honor, there is no handicap and there is no evidence that the prosecution doesn't play by the rules," Berg said forcefully. "Defense counsel has been engaged since the beginning of—"
"Stop it! Stop it!" Warfield shouted. "I do not intend to start my day playing referee to you two. I'm growing very weary of that. Now, as to the request, has counsel explored the possibility of teleconferencing this interview?"
"Yes, Your Honor," I said. "Believe me, that would be the way to go, but my investigator told me the prison does not make that available for meetings besides court hearings."
"Very well," Warfield said. "The court is going to allow Mr. Haller to interview this witness. I will make the appropriate notification to the bail and detention folks, and, Mr. Haller, you need to be back in this county by midnight tonight, or Miss Berg's prophecy will become true. You will be considered a fugitive. Is that understood?"
"Yes, Your Honor," I said. "Thank you. And if I could make one other quick request?"
"Here we go," Berg said. "What is it, Mr. Haller?" Warfield asked.
"Your Honor, I have the ankle monitor, and I'm sure that's going to be a problem at the prison in Nevada," I said.
"No way!" Berg jumped in forcefully. "You can't be serious. We are not going to accept him taking off the monitor.
The state... I'm not asking for that, I cut in. I'm asking for a letter from the court that maybe your honor's clerk could write up quickly and email me, explaining my standing if it comes into question. There was a pause, during which the judge was most likely waiting for Berg to object. But I thought the prosecutor probably believed she had overstepped with her loud objection to removal of the monitor. She had overplayed, and now was silent. Very well, Warfield said. I will craft a note and have Andrew email it to you. Thank you, Your Honor, I said. After the call, I contacted Bosch and told him I was coming. I told him to set up the appointment with Nederland for 2 p.m. This would give me time to fly over and be driven up to the prison. I also told Bosch to keep an eye out. I had to give Nederland's name to the prosecution, I said. I doubt they'll be able to get anybody out there before me, but they may try to fuck with us somehow. I'll stay right here, Bosch said. Look out for anything strange. Call when you're getting close. A quick shower and shave later, I was in fresh travel clothes and ready to go. I downloaded and printed the letter from Judge Warfield and put it in my briefcase. Kendall was awake and in the kitchen. There was a loud silence that she broke first. I'm sorry about last night, she said. I know you need to put everything you've got into your defense. I was being selfish. No, I'm sorry, I countered. I was ignoring you, and that should never be. I'll do better. I promise. The best thing you can do for me is win your case. That's the plan. We hugged it out. Then I kissed her goodbye. Bumbajan Bishop was sitting at the bottom of the stairs when I exited my house and locked the door behind me. Right on time, I said. I like that. Where are we going? He asked. Burbank Airport. I'm flying to Vegas. Then you're free until 8 tonight when I come back. I'll need you to pick me up. Got it. The jet suite terminal was not on the commercial airfield at Burbank. It was hidden in a long line of private jet operators and hangars. The beauty of the little-known airline was that it operated like a private jet, but provided commercial service. I got there 15 minutes before my flight, and it was no problem. The sold-out flight carried 30 passengers into the air above the San Gabriel Mountains, and then out over the Mojave Desert. I finally started to relax after the rush-rush morning. I had a window seat, and the woman next to me was wearing a surgical mask. I wondered if she was sick or trying to prevent becoming sick. I turned and looked down on the vast nothingness below. The brown, sunburned desert went in all directions as far as the eye could see. It made everything seem inconsequential, including me. Chapter 23. Harry Bosch was waiting for me in the front of the prison's main entrance. He met me at the door of my ride as I got out. The sun was blistering, and I'd forgotten to bring sunglasses. I squinted at him. Can I let this guy go and you drive me back to the airport? I asked. Flight's at 7. Yeah, no problem, he said. I made sure I had my briefcase, then tipped the driver and sent him off. Bosch and I started toward the prison entrance. You go through the doors, and then there's another door just for visiting attorneys. Head in through there, and it should be all set. Nederland is supposed to be in a room by 2. You can go through the attorney chute with me, I said. No, I'm not going in with you. It'll just be you and him, attorney-client. That's what I'm saying. You work for me as an investigator, and that puts you under the privilege umbrella. Yeah, but you're about to go to work for him, and I'm not working for that guy. What are you talking about? I pick my cases, Mick. I don't work for criminals. That would undo everything I ever did in my career. I stopped and looked at him for a moment. I guess I should take that as a compliment, I finally said. I told you at Dantana's that I believe you, he said. I wouldn't be here if I didn't. I turned and looked up at the prison.
Well, okay then, I said. I'll be out here, Bosch said. You get a name from him, I'll be ready to go to work on it. I'll let you know. Good luck.
I didn't get into a room with Niederland until 40 minutes later. The ankle monitor set off alarms with the jail staff, as I had thought it might. The letter from Judge Warfield was deemed not good enough because it could have been forged. Somebody called the judge's office to confirm that she had granted permission for me to travel to Nevada, but was told the judge was currently on the bench. It wasn't until Warfield took the mid-afternoon break and returned the call from Chambers that I was led to the attorney-client interview room. I was running a half hour late, and Niederland looked angry when I arrived. He sat in a chair across a bolted-down table from another chair. His hands were cuffed, and a lead chain ran from his wrists to a ring bolted to the front of his chair, which in turn was bolted to the floor. Still, he tried to stand and yanked hard against the chain as I slid into my seat. "Mr. Niederland, I'm Michael Haller," I began. "I'm sorry, I know who the fuck you are," he said. "You told my fuck you." "Excuse me? Get the fuck out of here. I just flew here from L.A. because you told my..." "Don't you fucking get it?" He yanked his cuffed hands up until the lead chain snapped taut again. His hands were gripped as if around an imaginary neck. My neck. "I didn't used to do this," he said. "Chain you down like this. Not with your lawyer." "I didn't know. I didn't fucking know. You should be dead by now, motherfucker." "What are you talking about?" I asked. "Why would I be dead?" "Because I would have broken your fucking neck." He pushed his words through gritted teeth. He wasn't a big man or heavily muscled. He had thin blonde hair and a sallow complexion. No surprise considering his current address. But the look of sheer hatred on his face was downright scary. My first thought was that somehow there'd been a setup and he was working for Louis Aparicio, a hitman in an elaborate scheme to take me out. But then I dismissed it. The circumstances of my visit defied such a plan, and there was clearly emotion behind the hate on Niederland's face. "You were going to kill me," I said. "Why?" "Because you killed my friend," he said, again through clenched teeth. "I didn't kill Sam Scales. That's why I'm here. I'm trying to find the person who did, and you just wasted a whole fucking day of my time and my investigator's time. You may not believe me, and I may even go down for it, but know this. There's someone else out there who did it and walked away, and by not helping me, you help him." I got up and turned to the steel door, raising my arm to pound on it. I was frustrated and angry, and wondering whether there would be an earlier flight back so that my entire day would not be wasted. "Wait a minute," Niederland said. I turned back to him. "Prove it," he said. "That's what I'm trying to do," I said. "And it doesn't help when I go off on a wild..." "No, I mean prove it, right here." "How do I do that?" "Sit down." He nodded to the empty seat. I reluctantly sat down. "I can't prove it to you," I said. "Not yet, at least." "He told me you betrayed him," Niederland said. "Yeah, the famous Lincoln lawyer. You went Hollywood when they made a movie about your ass and left all the people who counted on you in the gutter." "That's not what happened. I didn't go Hollywood. Sam stopped paying me. That was one thing, but the truth is, I just couldn't do it anymore. He was hurting a lot of people, taking their money, making them feel like fools. He got off on it, but I'd had enough. I couldn't take another case." Niederland didn't respond. I tried again. I wanted to win him over, because I still thought he could be helpful. "You were really going to kill me?" I asked. "With less than 2 years to go in here?" "I don't know," Niederland said. "But I was going to do something. I was mad. I still am." I nodded.
I could feel the temperature in the room subsiding. For what it's worth, I liked Sam, I said. He ripped off a lot of people, and that was hard to take, but somehow, I always liked him. I just had to draw the line, because what he was doing was reflecting on me in the media and at home. Added to that, he stopped paying me. And that was the same as treating me like one of the fools he ripped off.
He outstayed his welcome with a lot of people, Nederland said.
I could see a door of communication opening. But not you, I asked.
No, I never abandoned him, Nederland said. And he never abandoned me. We had plans for when I got out of here.
What were they?
Find one big score and then disappear?
What was the score? Did he already find it?
I don't know. It's not like he could put it in one of his letters. Everything here is monitored. Visitors, phone calls, letters. You're not even supposed to have contact with any ex-cons on the outside.
So how did you communicate? Nederland shook his head. He wasn't going to go there.
Hey, I'm your lawyer, I said. You can tell me anything, and they can't listen, and I can't repeat it. It's privileged.
Nederland nodded and relented.
He sent me letters, he said, posing as my uncle.
I paused for a moment. I knew the next question and answer could change everything about the case. I also knew that when people make up stories, plays, and even cons, they usually salt their stories with truth. Nederland had promised Harry Bosch a name if I came to the prison. Maybe that was the truth in his con.
What's your uncle's name? I asked.
Was, Nederland said. He's dead now. His name was Walter Lennon, my mother's brother.
Did you ever send Sam letters as your uncle?
Sure. What else is there to do in here?
And do you remember where you sent the letters?
He had a garage apartment in San Pedro. But that was 3 months ago, when he was alive. They probably put his shit out on the street.
Do you remember the address?
Yeah, I looked at a few of his letters this morning. The return was 2720 Cabrillo. He said it was small, he was saving, and we were going to get something bigger when I got out. He said we'd buy a place.
The vibe I was getting was that Nederland was talking about a romantic relationship without actually saying it. I realized that I had never known Sam Scales' sexual orientation because it didn't play a part in his crimes or our attorney-client relationship.
Did he tell you how he was getting the money he was saving?
He said he was working at the port.
Doing what?
He didn't say, and I didn't ask.
To Sam, working a job meant working at Grift. I wrote the name and address down on my legal pad. It would be considered work product and not discoverable.
Anything else you think I should know? I asked.
That's it, he said.
I thought about protecting the information I had just received, at least until we checked it out.
An investigator from the LAPD might come to see you, I said. They think I killed Sam, and that's all they're worried about. Just remember that you don't have to talk to them. I'm your lawyer now. You can refer them to me.
I won't tell them, Dick.
I nodded. That was what I wanted.
Okay, then, I said. I'm going to head back.
What about your trial? Nederland asked. Don't you want me to testify?
I wasn't sure how I could use him in my defense, or whether I could get the judge to approve it. Teleconferencing from prison to courtroom would probably put the jury to sleep. There was also the question of conflict of interest. Nederland was now technically my client, at least on paper at the prison.
I'll let you know, I said. I stood up again, ready to bang on the door.
Are you really going to find out who killed him? Nederland asked. Or are you just worried about proving you didn't?
The only way to prove I didn't do it is to prove who did, I said. That's the law of innocence. Part 3. Echoes and Iron. Chapter 24. Wednesday, January 15th. We got down to San Pedro by 9:30 the next morning. We drove separately. I was driven by Bishop because I needed to get to downtown before 1 p.m. for the hearing on the missing wallet. Bosch came in his old Cherokee and Cisco on his Harley. We convened at the house on Cabrillo that Austin Niederland had put me onto. There was an apartment for rent sign on the front lawn. Bishop had been cleared by Cisco, but you can never be 100% sure about anything. I didn't want him sitting in the Lincoln in front of the house. I told him to go get coffee nearby and wait for me to summon him when I was ready to go to court. I then approached the house with my investigators and knocked on the door. A woman in a bathrobe answered. I held up a business card and went with a script I had written in my head based on what I knew from Niederland. "Hello, ma'am. I'm Michael Holler, an attorney involved in the situation regarding the estate of Walter Lennon, and we are here to ascertain and review any property he left behind."
"Estate? Does that mean he's dead?"
"Yes, ma'am. Mr. Lennon passed in late October."
"Well, no one told us. We just thought he took off. He was paid up through November, but then December went by, and no sign of him and no rent check."
"I see the sign out front. You are re-renting the apartment?"
"Of course. He was gone, and he didn't pay."
"Are his belongings still in there?"
"No, we cleared him out. His stuff is in the garage. We wanted to dump it, but the law, you know. We have to wait 60 days.
"Well, thank you for adhering to the law. Do you mind if we look at the property in the garage?" She didn't answer. She closed the door about halfway so she could reach to something behind it. She then came up with a remote control and reached out the door to click it.
"Third bay," she said. "It's open now. The boxes are marked with his name and stacked between the tread marks."
"Thank you," I said. "Do you mind if we also look around the apartment? Just a quick check." She reached behind the door again and then handed me a key.
"Stairs are on the side of the garage," she said. "Bring it back when you're finished."
"Of course," I said.
"And don't mess it up. It's all clean. Mr. Lennon left it a mess."
"How so? What kind of mess?"
"Like a tornado, it hit the place. Broken furniture, his stuff thrown all over the floors. So don't be asking about his deposit. It barely covered what we had to do in there."
"Understood. Do you mind one more thing? We'd like you to look at a photo to confirm that the Walter Lennon we are talking about is the Walter Lennon you are talking about."
"I guess so."
Cisco had pulled a photo of Sam Scales up on his phone. It was a DMV photo that had been released to the media after my arrest. He held it up to the woman at the door, and she nodded after getting a look at it.
"That's him," she said.
"Thank you, ma'am," I said. "We won't take long."
"Just bring the key back," she said.
We started with the apartment, which was a small one-bedroom flat over the garage. The place had been cleaned and prepped for a new renter. We weren't expecting to find anything in plain sight, especially since the landlord's description indicated that it had already been searched. But Sam Scales was a lifelong con artist who might have reason to hide things in his home that a quick search might miss. The lead on this went to Bosch, who'd had many years of experience searching the homes of criminals. Bosch had brought a little tool bag with him. His first stop was the kitchen, where he was methodical about checking the underside of drawers, unscrewing and checking behind the kickboards beneath the cabinets, opening the insulation spaces in the refrigerator and freezer doors, and examining the light and fan assembly over the stove. When I realized how long his full search might take, I decided to change things up. I left Bosch in the apartment while Cisco and I went down to the garage. I had to make sure I got to the courthouse in time. There were two stacks of four cardboard boxes in the middle of the third bay, between the tread marks presumably left by renters' cars over time. The boxes were sealed, and each was marked with the name Lennon and the date 1219. Cisco started with one stack, and I started with the other. My first box contained clothes. There was a car in the second bay of the garage. I laid the clothes out on its hood and then went through each item, checking pockets, before returning it to the box. The second box contained shoes, socks, underwear, and nothing else. I checked the shoes inside and out and found a set of lace-up work boots with oily debris stuck in the treads. It reminded me of the oily substance found under Sam Scales' fingernails. I put the shoes aside and checked on Sisko. He was also dealing with clothes from the first two boxes. My third box contained personal items, including toiletries, a plug-in alarm clock, and several books. I fanned the pages of each, but found nothing hidden among them. They were all novels, except for one book, which was a 2015 owner's manual for a Mack Pinnacle tanker truck. I knew this fit in with BioGreen, but wasn't sure how. I set the manual aside on the hood of the car in the second bay. My fourth box contained more of the same. More books and personal items, such as a drip coffee maker and several coffee mugs that were wrapped in old newspaper. A layer of unopened mail was at the bottom of the box, probably put there to further cushion the fragile glass coffee pot and mugs. The mail was mostly junk, with the exception of an AT&T phone bill and an unopened letter from Austin Niederland with a return address, Nevada's High Desert State Prison. I put the prison letter unopened back into the box. It was apparent from my interview with Niederland that he didn't know what scam Sam Scales was into. I didn't think the letter would be of much use. Instead, I ripped open the phone bill to see if it included a list of numbers called. But it was a reminder notice that the prior bill was unpaid. There was a list of services Sam Scales was receiving, but no list of calls. Sisko was running one box behind me as he fanned the pages of books from his third box. I moved over and opened his last one. It contained three unopened boxes of honeycomb cereal and a fourth box of Rice Krispies. Sam liked his cereal, I guess. I shook and examined each box to see if it was factory sealed or Sam sealed to hide something inside. I decided they were just boxes of cereal and moved on. Below the cereal were some bags of ground coffee and other unopened items from kitchen cabinets.
"Look at this," Sisko said.
He held up a thin study manual for the California Commercial Driver's License exam.
"It's got stuff underlined in it," Sisko said, like he was really studying it.
"And I found an owner's manual for a Mack tanker truck," I said.
"I'll say it again. Maybe he was going straight, being a trucker or something."
No way. For Sam, working a square job was worse than prison. He was working a long con. He could never go straight.
Then what was it?
I don't know, but we're getting close. This is why they stole the wallet.
Why?
The wallet had his current alias. That would have led here and then to BioGreen. They didn't want us getting there.
Who is they?
We don't know yet. Maybe Aparicio, maybe the FBI. They're set up on Aparicio, and that place didn't want the investigation compromised by a murder investigation linked to BioGreen. As soon as the LAPD ran Sam's prints that night, the Bureau probably got an alert on it. They assess the situation and go grab the wallet before anybody looks at it. They come here, search the place, remove any connection. Sam is never linked to the Walter Lennon alias, and the investigation never gets to BioGreen.
So you're saying they just stood by while you got tagged with the murder and were going to let you go down for it?
I don't know. It had to have been a plan hatched without a lot of down-the-road thinking. Maybe they were just buying time to wrap things up on BioGreen. Then I blew up the schedule when I refused to waive speedy trial. Instead of a trial in July, or even later, it's February, and they didn't see that coming.
Maybe. A lot of maybes.
It's all speculation right now. But I think we're... Bosch entered the garage then, and I stopped. Anything upstairs? I asked.
Clean, he said.
I found a false floor storage space in the bedroom closet, but it wasn't hidden well and was empty. Whoever searched the place before would have found it.
How big? I asked. Could a laptop fit?
Yeah, it could fit, Barsh said.
That's what's missing here, I said. Sam used the internet for his scams. I can't see him without a computer. Plus, there's a phone bill in here for a full-service package, including home Wi-Fi. Why get Wi-Fi if you don't have a computer?
So we're missing a computer, a phone, and a wallet, Sisko said.
Exactly, I said.
What's in the boxes? Bosch asked.
Not much, I said. A pair of boots with grease in the treads. We're almost finished. I went back to the last box and saw that the bottom was lined with various documents and paperwork, things that were probably stuffed into a kitchen drawer. There was an instruction manual for the coffee maker, a set of step-by-step directions for putting together an IKEA table, and several opened letters from Nederland. That Scales had kept them reinforced in me the idea that they'd had a romantic relationship. There was also a trifold and stapled printout of a story from the New York Times. The headline read, "Bleeding the Beast." The story had a Salt Lake City dateline. I started reading, and by the time I finished, I knew that the story changed everything. And I knew that the printout was something I would need to turn over in discovery to the prosecution if I took it from the garage. I refolded the printout and dropped it back into the box. I picked up the Mack truck owner's manual and dropped it in as well. I then closed it up and stacked two other boxes on top of it. I pulled my phone and texted Bishop, telling him to come pick me up.
Okay, we're out of here, I said.
Wait, Sisko said. You don't want to take any of this stuff?
We take it. We have to share it, I said.
Discovery, Sisko said.
Let them discover it on their own, I said. They're not doing me any favors. I won't do any for them. Let's go. I have court.
I checked Bosch as we walked out to see if he showed any signs of discomfort with my decision to leave everything behind. I didn't see a thing. Bishop was pulling up out front as we emerged. I handed Sisko the key to the apartment.
You mind taking the key back to the old lady? I asked. And get her name and contact info to put on the witness list.
You got it, Sisko said.
Tell her we found nothing of value to the estate in the boxes. She can donate them or get rid of them any way she wishes, as soon as she wants to.
Sisko looked at me and nodded. He understood what I meant. Get rid of the property before the police or prosecution finally find the place.
I'll deliver the message, he said.
Chapter 25. Things had changed rapidly since the first hearing on Sam Scales' missing wallet. My outrage over the missing evidence and its impact on my case was now tempered by my team's findings of the last 48 hours. I believed I had learned the key secret of the wallet, the alias Sam was using in the last year of his life. And now, I didn't want to share that secret with the prosecution until I had to. I certainly didn't want it to be pursued by a court order or continue to be an issue. This led me to approach the hearing in Judge Warfield's courtroom cautiously and with a plan to score points, especially in front of the reporters who would be there, but to let sleeping dogs lie. Judge Warfield was again a solid 10 minutes late coming to the bench for the afternoon session. This gave me time to update Jennifer on the morning's activities. I told her about the Times story from Salt Lake City and the need to keep the knowledge it gave us under wraps. I cautioned her against printing out the story if she looked it up in the newspaper's archives.
If it's on paper, it goes into discovery, I said, so no paper.
Got it, Jennifer said. Also, there was a man in the story, a witness named Art Schultz. He was retired from the EPA. We need to find him and bring him in as a witness. He'll be key.
But what happens when we put him on the witness list? The prosecution will be all over it, and they'll figure out where we're going with this. Each side's witness list was included in discovery, and the court required an abbreviated summary of what every witness would testify to. Writing these so that they were accurate on face at the same time that they carried no hint of strategy or significance of the full testimony was an art form. "There's a way around it," I said, "to camouflage it. Make contact with Schultz and get his CV. He was with the EPA, so he probably has a biology degree or something like that. Put him on the list and say he'll testify in regard to the material found under the victim's fingernails. He'll be our grease expert and will probably fly well below the prosecution's radar, but once we get him on the stand, we'll use him to connect what's under the nails to what's going on at Biogreen." "Risky, but okay," Jennifer said. "I'll work on it after the hearing." The judge stepped out from the door to her chambers and took the bench. She first apologized for being late, explaining that a monthly judge's luncheon had run long. She then got down to business. "This is a continuation of a motion to compel discovery by the defense, and I believe, Miss Berg, that I instructed you to investigate the matter of a missing wallet and to report back to the court. What have you found?" Berg stepped over to the lectern to address the court. She looked pained as she adjusted the level of the microphone. "Thank you, Your Honor," she said. "Simply stated, the wallet remains missing. Over the past 2 days, Detective Drucker has conducted an investigation and is here to testify if necessary, but the wallet was not found. The people concede that the video evidence presented by the defense Monday is conclusive in that regard. There does appear to have been a wallet in the victim's back pocket at the time the body was discovered in the trunk of the defendant's car, but it was not among the personal property that was later turned over to the LAPD at the coroner's office." "Have you determined when it was taken or by whom?" Warfield pressed. "No, Your Honor," Berg said. "The procedure is that the body would have been transported to the coroner's office, where it would have been placed in the prep room. That's where clothing and property is removed, and the bodies are prepared for autopsy, while the property is sealed and held for the police. In this case, specifically, the body was discovered in the evening and therefore not delivered to the prep room until approximately 2 a.m. This means that autopsy prep would not have occurred until the morning. So, the body would have just been sitting there, unattended?" the judge asked. "Not exactly," Berg said. "It would have been moved to a large refrigerated crypt that is part of the coroner's office." "So it was in with other bodies?" "Yes, Judge." "Not isolated?" "Not beyond being in a crypt where authorized access is required." "Did Detective Drucker check to see if there are any surveillance cameras in the area?" "He did, and there are no cameras." "So we have no way of knowing who may have gained access to this crypt and taken the wallet?" "That is correct at this time." "At this time? Do you think that is going to change?" "No, Your Honor." "What is it that the people suggest I do about this, Miss Berg?" "Your Honor, the people make no excuse for the loss of this property. However, it is a loss that impacts both sides equally. Neither the people nor the defense has the opportunity to access the wallet and whatever case information, if any, it contained. Therefore, it is the people's position that while we accept responsibility for the loss, the damage, if any, is equal." Warfield digested that for a few moments before responding. "Something tells me that Mr. Haller is not going to agree with that assessment," she said. "Would the defense like to respond?" I was up quickly and to the lectern almost before Berg had time to step away. "Yes, Your Honor is exactly right," I said. "The damage to the defense and prosecution can in no way
be considered equal. The state sits fat and happy with the case just as it is, Your Honor. They have a body in the trunk of a car, and they've charged the driver. No need to dig deeper than that. Case closed. They didn't even raise a question about the missing wallet until the defense did. They clearly weren't interested, because the wallet and what ID the victim was using could lead to what Sam Scales was up to on the last days of his life, and that might not fit with the neat package they have put together on me. It is clear, Judge, that the damage here is to the defense, not the prosecution. Say I agree with you, Mr. Holler, Warfield said. What is the remedy the defense seeks?
There is no remedy. The defense wants the wallet. That's the remedy.
Then what is the penalty? There appears to be no evidence of sinister behavior by those involved in the investigation. The wallet appears to have been stolen by someone who had access to the body while it was in custody of the coroner's office. The matter will certainly be referred for internal investigation by the coroner, but the court does not feel inclined to punish the prosecution for this unfortunate set of circumstances.
I shook my head in frustration, even though I knew this was heading toward the outcome I had expected and, based on the morning's discoveries, wanted.
Your Honor, I said, for the record, then, I want it noted that the investigation of the missing evidence carried out by the prosecution was conducted by the same detective who is in charge of protecting the crime scene and the evidence in this case.
So noted, Mr. Holler, Warfield said. Any other matters before we adjourn?
Yes, Your Honor, Berg said. I relinquished the lectern to her and headed back to my seat, shaking my head as if frustrated by the judge's ruling.
Excuse me, Ms. Berg, Warfield said. Mr. Holler, I noted your demonstration. Are you upset with the court's decision?
I stopped in my tracks.
Your Honor, I'm just frustrated, I said. I'm trying to put together a defense, and it seems that at every turn I am thwarted. The people lost the wallet by negligence or malfeasance. Doesn't really matter, and I will pay for it. That's all.
I advise counsel on both sides to keep their emotions and demonstrations in check, Warfield said, particularly when we go to trial. The court will have no patience for such outbursts then, not in front of a jury.
Judge, I would not call it an outburst. I was just—
Are you going to argue with the court now as well, Mr. Holler?
No, Your Honor. I continued to my seat, and Warfield tracked me with her eyes in case I so much as frowned. Finally, she broke away and looked at the prosecutor.
Ms. Berg, continue, she said.
Judge, yesterday, we received the first witness list from the defendant, Berg said. It had only two names on it, the defendant himself and his investigator. This from a defendant who has twice come before this court to complain about discovery issues, and he has the audacity to put just two names down on his witness list?
Warfield looked like she was either weary of the constant crossfire between the prosecution and defense, or was being hit with fatigue from the two martinis she'd probably had at the judge's lunch. I was sure the alcohol was what had inspired her to snap at me. Before I could object to Berg's complaint, Warfield held her hand up to me, indicating that she was not interested in my response.
It's early, Miss Berg, Warfield said. We are still almost 30 days out, and there will be an update on the lists from both parties next week and every week after. Let's wait a bit before we panic about whom he plans to call. Anything of a more serious nature?
No, Your Honor, Berg said. No, Your Honor, I said.
Very well, Warfield said. Then we are adjourned.
Chapter 26. Having not had time to eat before the hearing,
I went to the Little Jewel for a shrimp po' boy sandwich directly after court. I was joined by everyone on the defense team except Bosch. He was apparently off doing his own thing again and was incommunicado. I told the team that the defense had turned a corner with the case knowledge gathered in the last 48 hours, and that it was time to start thinking in terms of presenting the case to a jury. We could clearly anticipate what the prosecution presentation would be, because it had not really changed since the start of the case. We could prepare for that, but what was more important was preparing to tell our story. A trial often comes down to who is a better storyteller, the prosecution or the defense. There is evidence, of course, but physical evidence is at first interpreted for the jury by the storyteller. Story A. A man kills an enemy, puts the body in the trunk, and plans to bury it late at night when there will be no one around to see it. Story B. A man is set up for the murder of a former client and unwittingly drives around with the body in the trunk until he is pulled over by police. The physical evidence fits both stories. One might be more believable than the other when writ small, but a skilled storyteller can even the scales of justice, or maybe even tip them the other way, with a different interpretation of the evidence. This was where we were now, and I was starting to get the visions I got before all trials. Visions of witnesses on the stand, visions of me telling my story to a jury. "We are clearly going for third-party culpability," I said, "and the guy we point the finger at is going to be Louis Aparicio. I doubt he pulled the trigger, but he gave the order. So he is our fall guy and our number one witness. We need to find him. We need to paper him. We need to make sure he shows up for court." Jennifer Aronson shook her hands palms out like she was warding off a swarm of bees. "Can we just back up?" she asked. "Walk me through this like I'm a juror. What are we saying happened? I mean, I get it. Aparicio killed Scales, or had Scales killed, and then tried to frame you for it. But can we say yet exactly how this went down?" "Nothing is exact at this point," I said. "But we have a lot of holes to fill. That's why we're meeting right now. But I can tell you what I think went down, and what the evidence, once we have it all, is going to prove." "Yes, please," Lorna said. "I'm with Jen. I'm having a hard time seeing this." "Not a problem," I said. "Let's go through it slowly. A couple things to start with first. Number one is Louis Aparicio's enmity for me. 9 years ago, I sandbagged him in court, revealing his mob connections and shady dealings in the foreclosure world. In that case, he was a straw man. He was the shiny bait I put out in front of the jury, and they went for it. Though he was not the killer I portrayed him as in court, he was involved in some shady shit. The government took notice, and he and his mob backers ended up forfeiting major millions when the Federal Trade Commission reversed a $100 million merger he had just completed. I think all of that explains why he would hold a grudge against me. Not only did I expose him in public, but I cost him and his mob backers a ton of money."
"No doubt," Sisko said. "I'm surprised he waited until now to make a move against you. 9 years is a long time."
"Well, maybe he was waiting until he had the perfect frame," I said, "because I'm in a tight box."
"That's for sure," Lorna said.
"Okay, so the second building block of our case is the victim," I said. "Sam Scales, con man extraordinaire. Our story is that these two, Aparicio and Scales, intersected at BioGreen. They were bleeding the beast, operating the long con, when something went wrong. Aparicio had to take out Scales, but also had to make sure the investigation came nowhere near BioGreen. So I became his fall guy. He somehow knew of my history with Scales and that it ended badly. He sticks Sam's body in my trunk, and I go down for it while BioGreen stays clean and supposedly keeps pumping out that recycled fuel the government loves so much. I looked at the three faces around the table. Questions? I asked.
I have a couple, Lorna said. First, what was the con they were pulling?
It's called bleeding the beast, I said. Scamming the government, the beast, that is, out of federal subsidies for producing green gold, recycled oil.
Whoa, Lorna said. Sounds like Sam really came up in the world. That's a long way from the internet scams he was known for.
Good point, I said. That is something that doesn't fit with what I know about him. But I'm just telling you my theory so far. He has green gold under his fingernails. One thing we do need to find out is whether Sam went to Aparicio with the scam idea, or was Sam simply recruited into the ongoing operation.
Any idea what the falling out was? Jennifer asked. Why was Sam killed?
Another hole we have to fill, I said. And my guess is that the FBI is at the bottom of that hole.
They flipped him, Sisko half-asked, half-suggested.
I nodded. I think it's something along those lines, I said. Aparicio found out, and Sam had to go.
But the smart move would have been to just make him disappear, Sisko said. Why put the body any place where it could and would be found?
Right, I said. That goes on the list of unknowns. But I think that simply disappearing Sam might have brought in more scrutiny from the feds. Doing it the way they did would help insulate BioGreen and maybe make it look like it had nothing to do with the scam down there.
Not to mention Aparicio knew this was a good way to get back at you, boss, Sisko added.
Most of this is just theory, Jennifer said. What's next? How do we turn theory into a solid defense?
Aparicio, I said. We find him, serve him, and make sure the judge enforces the subpoena.
That only gets him to court, Jennifer said. Last time you wanted him to take the Fifth, but this time you have to get him to actually testify.
Not necessarily, I said. If we have the goods on him, it'll be about the questions we ask, not the answers. He can take the Fifth all he wants. The jury will hear the story in the questions. I turned my eyes to Sisko.
So where is he? I asked.
We've been on the girlfriend, what, 5 days now? Sisko said. And no sign of him. We may need to shake things up, throw a scare at her, create a need for her to see him.
I shook my head. I think it's too early for that, I said. We have some time. We don't want to subpoena him till pretty late in the game. Otherwise, Iceberg will be on to us.
She is already, Jennifer said.